Hello, I'm Barbara Tobias, and this is City Beat. This is the September 18th through 24th, 2019 edition. And continuing on from last week, will Co-op Market be part of a coming Northside development? After Apple Street Market hit funding snags, Northside's Community Development Corporation says it had to tap another developer, but there may be hope for the grocery initiative. This article is by Nick Swartzell. After an effort to establish a cooperatively owned grocery store in Northside hit major funding hurdles earlier this year, a new plan for the store's potential site is coming together. Whether or not that larger development will have space for the grocery, however, is still up in the air. Officials with Northside Community Development Corporation, Northsiders Engaged in Sustainable Transformation, or NEST, say they will soon announce the developer chosen for the site. NEST also says that developer and organizers for the Apple Street Market are meeting to discuss the feasibility of a grocery store as part of a larger development that NEST hopes will include affordable housing funded via low-income housing tax credits. Our goal is affordable housing development on the site, says NEST Executive Director Sarah Thomas. We're going to have to meet all sorts of qualifications. We have the simultaneous goal of food access in the neighborhood, so it's a dream to incorporate them into the site. Apple Street Market Board President Kristen Barker says the grocery initiative is hopeful about the potential partnership. "What I think, what everyone wants, is for this joint project to work," she says. "There are a variety of challenges around it in terms of the size of space and pricing, but I feel like we're all going to bring all the creativity." NEST received more than $500,000 from the city of Cincinnati last year to purchase the former Save-A-Lot at 4145 Apple Street that's been floated as the market's home since the low-cost grocer pulled out of the building in 2013. As part of that funding agreement, it must be in development on a project at the site within 24 months. Organizers with Apple Street played a big role in lobbying for the city for that money under the assumption the site would be used for the grocery. Some political aversion to co-op grocery models, with struggles with Clifton Market, another co-op grocery up the road in Clifton, made some members of Cincinnati City Council and Mayor John Cranley reluctant to give the funding to Apple Street directly. Last year, however, it seemed as though Apple Street was making strides towards opening in the market with NEST serving as the owners of the building. Then a number of cards fell out of Apple Street's financing deck. At a February emergency meeting in South Cumminsville, members of the Apple Street Market Board told more than 70 of the project's 1,279 shareholders that a large chunk of the project's financing had fallen apart just before implementation. In late January, the Columbus-based finance fund withdrew $900,000 in seed financing from the project because Apple Street had not yet raised enough operating capital, but that was just the start of the bad news. The market this month was supposed to close on new market tax credits worth $1.5 million in financing for development costs. But PNC, the investor in those credits, is withdrawing from many of its 2019 new market projects due to devaluation in the credits caused by tax reforms passed by Congress in 2017. The Cincinnati Development Fund holds the credits. Because of the financing difficulties, CDF must allocate them to other projects, though Apple Street organizers say CDF now has a new round of credits available. "We're in a totally new situation at this moment," Barker said at the time. "Losing that tax allocation is a very big deal." Grocery stores in low to moderate income neighborhoods, while they can be very successful long term, they need subsidy in the short term. The loss of funding came after the market spent $377,000 between June 14 and January of this year on expenses like paying three employees, including $130,000 to a general manager over that time. Conducting outreach efforts, a market study and retail planning, paying for design and engineering costs, and paying membership dues to Associated Wholesale Grocers, a major cooperative food wholesaler. The loss of funding from the tax credits toppled another domino. NEST said the lost financing forced its hand to release a request for qualifications for other developers interested in the building. NEST will announce the developer it selected in the coming days. Thomas says, and is focused on developing affordable housing at the site using LIHTC credits, low-income tax credits. That, too, could be difficult. However, last year, Cincinnati opted into a program through the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, which administers the federal credits called FH Act 50, which allowed the city to choose a single neighborhood over the Rhine to receive LIHTC subsidies outside the state's normal competitive process. In return, it gave up scoring advantages afforded to Ohio's largest cities in that process. In recent years, Cincinnati has lagged behind Ohio's other major cities when it comes to applying for and winning the credits. And its participation in the FH Act 50 program could make it more difficult for developers outside of OTR to win the credits. Thomas, however, says Nest is committed to pursuing the credits. It's no secret that LIHTC is highly competitive, she says. That's why we're pushing for a 2020 application, and that remains the focus. We have a lot of work to do along the way. Community engagement, design. Everyone's goal is the highest subsidy possible because we know what the neighborhood needs. We selected our co-developer based on our notion of wanting a true community partner. We're prepared for what we have to do to make the right thing for the site, even if it's not on the first attempt. She said that Nest, Apple Street, and the developer should know in 2 to 4 weeks whether it will be feasible to incorporate the projects. Meanwhile, Apple Street says it's bouncing back from its funding fallout and securing contributions that will help it put financing back together. The financial picture is pretty positive overall, Barker said last month. We had a goal to get to $1 million raised from members by September. We're close to $800,000. Last month, organizers announced the market effort had been tapped for an $800,000 grant from the United States Department of Agriculture's Health Food Financing Initiative. The co-op effort is one of 23 initiatives receiving an inaugural round of funding from the USDA program, which is aimed at expanding access to fresh food in areas where its availability is limited. 10 of those projects, including Apple Street, will receive financial help totaling $1.4 million. More than 240 applicants from 46 states were vying for the grants. Reinvestment Fund, that's a national financial institution that administered the grants, says they're about revitalizing communities in an equitable way. Access to healthy food is about more than making sure all Americans have easy access to nutritious, affordable food. It's also about strengthening local economies and community infrastructure, said Reinvestment Fund President and CEO Don Hinkle Brown in a news release. The response to this funding opportunity is indicative of the immense need and the innovative approaches communities are undertaking to support equitable access to fresh, healthy food for everyone. The former Save-A-Lot location is more or less the only place available in Northside right now that would work for the market, Barker says, since getting supply agreements with the market's choice wholesaler, AWG, requires a larger building than most other locations would allow. We've looked at a lot of spaces, she says. There is not another adequate space in Northside at this time. That's not to say nothing would open up in some period of time. We also did market studies in some other areas that didn't work, as well as this site. The Groceries Initiative last market study conducted about a year ago also led Apple Street to revise its business plan somewhat, Barker says. Boosters say the market's conservative sales projections set it apart from Clifton Market, which struggled with sluggish sales. As a result of that particular study, we reduced our projections slightly, she says. They're even more conservative now. The Save-A-Lot made $65,000 a week. We reduced our projections to less than that, $61,000. Apple Street still faces hurdles, however, including raising enough money to unlock the financing it will need to move forward. That's a bit of a moving target, Barker says, since the market doesn't know exactly how much its portion of a shared project could cost yet. In the meantime, all parties are trying to see how the pieces could fit together. They have wonderful momentum, Thomas says of Apple Street. It's amazing to see people rally around this, but a ton of work remains. And next, first downtown Kroger in decades gets an opening date. And this article is also by Nick Swartzell. Cincinnati's new Kroger location at Court and Walnut Street will open, actually yesterday, September 25th, company officials announced. It'll be Kroger's first downtown grocery store since the location on Ray Street closed in 1969. The store will be open from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily, the company says. Urbanists and elected city leaders have salivated at the idea of a downtown store for years. But before 2017, when the project on Walnut was announced, the pieces had never come together. A second floor food court featuring Eli's Barbecue, Django Western Taco, Dope Asian Street Fair, Queen City Whip, and Kroger's own Kitchen 1883 Cafe and Bar will also open September 25th. The Cincinnati-based grocer partnered with the city to build a 45,000-square-foot two-story store as part of a mixed-use development. That project also includes an 18-story, 139-unit market-rate apartment tower and a 550-space parking garage. North American Properties, North Point Group, and Rookwood Properties are developers on the project. GBBN serves as the architect and Turner Construction is the development's general contractor. Kroger says the store is meant to serve customers living in downtown, over the Rhine, the West End, and other nearby neighborhoods. The store will have a bar, the aforementioned food court, and other novel amenities. Among the perks, a walk-up Starbucks window for pedestrians on the Court Street side of the store. The almost $91 million project received an $8.5 million grant from a city fund that must be used for downtown development. $4 million from the Ohio Development Services Agency, $2.5 million in state and federal new market tax credits, and about $7 million from 3CDC, $19 million from Kroger, and $42 million in private investment. A nearby store in Over the Rhine on Vine Street will be torn down after the coming downtown store opens. And continuing on, from City Desk by Nick Swartzell, facing a cancer battle, Todd Portoon won't seek re-election. At an emotional news conference on September 12th, Hamilton County Commission member Todd Portoon announced he won't run for re-election next year as he battles cancer again. Portoon, a Democrat and former president of the commission, has long battled health challenges during his five terms on the board. Over the past two decades, the 61-year-old has powered through bouts with cancer that included the amputation of part of his left leg and spinal issues. Now, however, he says it's time to retire. "The fact of the matter is chemotherapy has not worked and my cancer has spread," he said. "And so having learned that I'm now in a spot where I've got the biggest fight of my life ahead of me, that's not going to allow me to do the things I want to do the same way I want to do them." Prior to his stint on the county commission, Portoon served 8 years with Cincinnati City Council, beginning with an appointment in 1993 and continuing through four re-elections. He's also chaired or been president of a number of other governmental bodies, including the Hamilton County Transportation Improvement District, the Hamilton County Homeland Security Commission, the Ohio-Kentucky-Indiana Regional Council of Governments, and more. Portoon first won election to the commission in 2000, when he was the first Democrat in 35 years to grab a seat on the county commission. Times have changed since then, and he now serves with two other Democrats, Commission President Denise Driehaus and Stephanie Sumaro Dumas. During his time on the board, he's pushed to trim the county's budget during lean years, while at times dueling with the Cincinnati Bengals over the county stadium deal with the team. He also helped find funding for Cradle Cincinnati, an effort launched in 2012 to fight the county's high infant mortality rate. Portoon faced a challenge from Republican Andy Black this time around, and it's likely his announcement will open up the field to other Democratic and Republican hopefuls. Hamilton County has become a reliably blue county in both local and statewide elections, and the Democrat who started it all was Todd Portoon, running a courageous and gutsy race to win a county commission seat in 2000, the Ohio Democratic Party chair David Pepper said in a statement. Ever since, he's been a mentor to an entire generation of Hamilton County Democrats, blazing the path for others to succeed. I was fortunate to be one of the beneficiaries of his generous support, wise guidance, and warm friendship. Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley also lauded Portune. In addition to improving our community in thousands of ways, the eternal values of human rights Commissioner Portune has fought for will be the most important and enduring of his legacy, Cranley said in a statement. He fought for gay rights before it was popular, against police brutality before it was popular, for disability inclusion before it was popular, for harm reduction and addiction help before it was popular, for all minorities and for those who had no voice. That's the legacy his kids will know, and I will trumpet. It's the legacy that's inspired all of us, myself included. Portune fought back tears as he reflected on retiring from a job he relishes. There's no job that I love more than the job I have now, he said. It's what I am. It's what I've been about. And next, Planned Parenthood to shutter two local clinics by Nick Swartzel. Officials with Planned Parenthood Southwestern Ohio announced on September 9th that the organization will close two area clinics in Springdale and Western Hills that provide birth control, sexually transmitted infection or STI screenings, and cancer tests due to state and federal regulations. The two locations slated for closure do not provide abortions. Their final day of operations was September 20th. There are five other Planned Parenthood clinics in the region. According to Planned Parenthood, the closures are due to a series of state and federal laws aimed at wresting public funding for health services away from organizations that also provide abortions. And those include a 2016 law signed by then Ohio Governor John Kasich that stripped such state funding for sexually transmitted infections and HIV testing and training for women about healthy relationships and infant mortality reduction measures from Planned Parenthood. A three-judge panel on the federal Sixth Circuit Court declared that law unconstitutional, but the full court in March reversed that decision. Another blow in August came when the federal government began enforcing new rules for its so-called Title X funds or Title X funds, which provide money for birth control and other reproductive health care. Those rules include stipulations that providers using the funds cannot discuss abortion with patients, and the clinics receiving the funds have to be in separate facilities from those providing abortions. That hit Planned Parenthood hard, the organization says, despite the fact that it serves roughly 40% of the patients who receive services through Title X. Planned Parenthood has indicated it will drop out of the Title X program over the rules. Conservatives in the Ohio General Assembly and officials in the Trump administration say the respective rules are meant to keep public dollars from funding abortion. Officials with Planned Parenthood, meanwhile, say they're about blocking women's access to the procedure. Cincinnati is the last place politicians should be forcing health centers to close, Planned Parenthood Southwest Ohio President and CEO Kersha Diebel said in a statement. While we've been battling sky-high sexually transmitted infection rates, politicians like Senator Rob Portman, Representative Steve Shabbat, and Governors Mike DeWine and John Kasich have spent years relentlessly working to chip away at Ohio's reproductive health care. This is the world they want to see, one where women lose access to birth control, where information about how to access abortion is held hostage, and where if you don't have money, it's almost impossible to access a sexually transmitted infection test or a cancer screening. And continuing on, Shabbat campaign treasurer says he didn't know he was the campaign treasurer. This is by Nick Swartzel. The man listed for years on the campaign finance filings for 12-term Republican Congressman Steve Shabbat released a statement on September 9th disavowing any major involvement with Shabbat's campaign, claiming he had no idea he was listed as its treasurer. An attorney for Jim Schwartz Sr. issued the statement, deepening a mystery surrounding a more than $120,000 gap the Federal Elections Commission found in financial disclosure statements submitted by Shabbat's campaign. The investigation into that unexplained gap is believed to center around Schwartz's son, prominent Republican consultant and longtime Shabbat staffer, Jamie Schwartz. The FEC sent a letter addressed to Jim Schwartz late last month asking questions about the gap, and a review of filings with the FEC shows that Jim Schwartz Sr. was listed as the Shabbat campaign's treasurer as early as 2011, but the elder Schwartz said he was unaware of that. I am not now, nor have I ever been, the treasurer of the Steve Chabot for Congress campaign. The statement from his attorney, Daniel J. McCarthy, reads, "I have never served the campaign in any official capacity, including as treasurer at any time. I played no role in the campaign other than that as an occasional volunteer. I had no knowledge of the use of my name on any campaign documents or filings until recent reports." That was news to Chabot's campaign, which had said it thought the elder Schwartz had been its treasurer since 2011. Mark Braden, an attorney for Chabot's campaign, said in a statement that Chabot is the victim of financial malfeasance. Congressman Chabot was shocked and deeply disappointed to be informed that his campaign committee may be the victim of financial malfeasance and misappropriation of funds, the statement reads. Unfortunately, the misappropriation of funds by some campaign treasurers has been far too common an occurrence over the years. Chabot beat Democratic challenger Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Perival last year, netting 51% of the vote in a district that includes both blueing Hamilton County and deep red Warren County. One of the more dramatic issues in that campaign hinged on questions around Perival's use of money from his Clerk of Courts campaign account for his congressional run. The Ohio Elections Committee eventually dropped most of the charges against Perival, who was fined only $100 for paying a photographer who captured his congressional bid announcement from his Clerk of Courts campaign account. In the aftermath of the FEC's letter, Fountain Square Group, a campaign strategy firm run by the younger Schwartz, abruptly deleted its Facebook page. Schwartz has been a longtime high-level campaign staff member for Chabot, as well as an employee in his congressional office, and Fountain Square Group has a number of contracts with other local Republican campaigns, including Hamilton County Commission candidate Andy Black. The younger Schwartz has not yet released a statement yet. The FEC has asked Chabot to respond to its questions by October 1st. And moving ahead in this section of City Beat's Arts and Culture, Buddy Comedy, Anderson Cooper and Andy Cohen take their longtime friendship on the road for an intimate live show called AC2. This is by Jack Kern. Back when there was a more prominent distinction between news and entertainment, it might have seemed like the worlds of Anderson Cooper and Andy Cohen would hardly intersect. Cooper is a veteran journalist, CNN anchor, and 60 Minutes correspondent. Cohen is best known as the face of TV network Bravo, popularizing the Real Housewives franchise and hosting this boozy late-night talk show, Watch What Happens Live. But much like the ever-changing worlds of politics and pop culture, the two have plenty in common. They've both won an Emmy Award, written best-selling books, and look really good with gray hair. And there's reality television, lest we forget Cooper's brief stint as host of The Mole. Cohen and Cooper met on a blind date more than 25 years ago and have been close pals ever since. Their comedic chemistry has been on display on social media. WWHL, Watch What Happens Live, and CNN's New Year's Eve Live, which the pair has hosted since 2017-18. Over the past 4 years, they've taken their friendship and all its stories on the road as part of their show, AC2 Live, an intimate evening with Anderson Cooper and Ace and Andy Cohen, which makes a stop in Cincinnati Friday, October 4th. The tour offers an unscripted, unfiltered, informal, and intimate fireside chat with two silver foxes, complete with an audience-engaged Q&A portion and embarrassing old video clips to boot. "It's like going out to a bar with us and hearing our stories," Cohen says, evoking a similar vibe to WWHL. Each show is unique, with topics changing depending on what's happening in their lives and around the world. Cooper explains whether it's a presidential debate or a housewives reunion, which Andy now feels are pretty much the same thing. Cohen chimes in he's always in the middle of some piece of pop culture nonsense, and Anderson's always in the middle of some world event or crisis or controversy, though they both insist that AC2 is not political. "There's so much division, so much politics now," Cooper says. "We just want it to be a night where everybody can come and just enjoy themselves." While neither are strangers to being on camera or in the public eye, the idea of performing in front of a large, often sold-out audience is still new and exciting to both of them. "For me, it's a huge change," Cooper, who hosts CNN's Anderson Cooper 360, says. "Usually, I'm either on location just talking to a camera, or I'm in a studio that's essentially a dark room with a lot of lights. So to have a live audience and get their instant reaction, to get them to laugh and respond to stories, is unlike anything else. Learning and developing that skill in front of an audience is really cool. I can understand why stand-up comedians or people in Broadway shows love it so much, because it's incredible. While many are quick to peg Cohen as the comedian and Cooper as the straight man, they say fans will be surprised to see the newsman's more humorous side, which is typically reserved for his friends. "I've learned how loose and funny Anderson is," Cohen says. "I think there's a huge surprise for people. I think people expect me to be kind of silly, but they see a totally different side of Anderson, and they love it." As is tradition on WWHL, the duo offers their Maisel and Jackhole of touring experiences, their most and least favorite aspect. Think the Rose Thorn Peak Pit sharing exercise. Both agree that traveling the country with a close friend is a highlight. "When we first met each other, neither of us were well known to other people," Cooper says. "Andy was working behind the scenes at CBS News as a producer, and I had just started traveling around the world, covering wars and trying to become a correspondent. So it's great to have a friendship where your careers have evolved together. To end up in this interesting, strange place in terms of our careers, and to have somebody else to share that with, and then to be able to share it in a funny way and give a whole different perspective on it to audiences, it's just a delight." They're excited to bring their show to the Queen City for the first time. Cohen is set on trying graders while he's here. When they have time, they explore new cities together. They even once showed up at a house party after someone invited Cohen via Instagram after their show, but often head back to their hotel to unwind before jetting off to the next stop. Which brings us to the Jackholes. For Cohen, it has to do with late-night munchies. "My Jackhole is how long room service takes at midnight when we get back to the hotel. And we're so hungry," Cohen says. "Somehow there's always a very long delay." Cooper confirms this, recalling a time when Cooper repeatedly called room service to check on an order, claiming it was a double rush, which isn't even a thing. What's a double rush, he asks, only to reveal they were actually calling from Cooper's room all along. "They thought it was me," Cooper recalls, pausing to contemplate his own Jackhole. "Well, I guess there was the guy that punched me," Cooper offers nonchalantly, reserving any juicy details. "Perhaps they'll regale us with the full story at the show." If you want to go to the show, AC2 Live, an intimate evening with Anderson Cooper and Andy Cohen, takes place 8 p.m. Friday, October 4th at the Aronoff Center's Procter & Gamble Hall. For tickets and more information, cincinnatiarts.org. And next, visual art. People's Liberty looks to the future. People's Liberty's final installation opened at their Over the Rhine Globe Front Gallery location on September 13th. Staying true to that organization's 5 years of forward-thinking projects, an exhibition curated by Wavepool entitled Advice for Future Homecomers is posited at looking ahead in anticipation. "They wanted to go out with a really beautiful, thoughtful show," says Cal Cullen, executive director of Wavepool. "They didn't want a recap of all of what People's Liberty had done in the past. They didn't want some sort of time capsule yearbook, but they wanted something that summarized the feel of People's Liberty and their community engagement, but almost was a call to action for the community to step up and fill in their place." The term homecomers is one used by prominent Kentucky writer Wendell Berry. "A homecomer is one who leaves their home, believing they must travel far and wide to make their difference in the world, returning home only upon the realization that everything they sought was there all along." This happens in Cincinnati all the time, Colin says. People call us boomerangs. It's about coming back to your roots and has to do with the Cincinnati phenomenon of homecoming, but also this idea of seeing the future by returning back. To achieve that end, Cullen enlisted several artists, both local and beyond. Elise Daniels, Lizzie Duquette, Llewellyn Fletcher, Catherine Whithead, the Archive of Creative Culture, and Kristen Schmidt. Schmidt's practice is primarily focused on small-scale sculpture making, but for this installation, Colin asked him to marry his practice with another, perhaps unexpected passion of his, bread making. Bread, this very fundamental and universal thing of sustenance. You're handing it to people. The gesture of that, I think it's really powerful, Schmidt says. It's hard to really overcomplicate it. It's not something that needs to be overanalyzed. It's just a gesture of warmth and community. From 9 to 11 a.m. every Friday and Saturday through the end of the exhibition, Schmidt will host pretzel-making workshops in the Globe Front, starting at noon on those days. He'll take a pretzel cart through Findlay Market and neighboring streets to dispense pretzels to anyone in exchange for one thing, advice. My thinking is there's been a lot of people moving into the community and setting up new businesses. Companies will build luxury apartments, and they don't really ever talk to people on the street, Schmidt says. I think there are a lot of very invasive species that enter into communities and don't really consider the needs of the community. What do they need? The pretzels will be a gesture of saying, I come in peace. And then if you have the time, could you trade me some advice? Schmidt's bread-making business, Tall's Bread, operates out of Trinity Episcopal Church's basement in Covington. And that's all the time we have. To see this show, Advice for Newcomers, or excuse me, Advice for Future Homecomers, it runs through November 10th at the People's Liberty Globe Front, 1805 Elm Street, and over the Rhine. For more information, wavepoolgallery.org. I'm Barbara Tobias. This has been City Beat. Have a great week.